But still, it grew up to be quite a large population, as you well know. So we ended up now with the heart of project management in Anchorage, with the pipeline part of the project headquartered in Fairbanks, and we still had operations going in San Francisco, and we still have an operation going on in Anaheim, and we will have for another year. And the Bellevue office was terminated, and so the president and the other vice presidents all moved up to Alaska and all headquartered in Anchorage. And then, of course, we had to open up an office for the stations and the terminal, and we decided that we would open, obviously, the terminal location had to be Valdez, and we opened up the station headquarters here in town, and they're located, as you know, in the Polaris building. So we run our station activity out of Fairbanks, we run our pipeline out of Fairbanks, we run our terminal at the terminal, and we coordinate all the activities in Anchorage. Now, so you see this project management structure that we have just kept changing, it changing to fit the needs. Now, most recently, we re-examined where we were and where should we go from there. And that was when we changed the role of Bechtel from a CMC to what we call a CTSC, or a construction technical services contractor. And the reason we did that, we examined our entire operation, and we came to the conclusion that we had, with all of the planning work essentially done, we were in a sort of a steady state operation rather than a growth operation. And so we stopped growing, and we sort of reached a steady state, and there we had a one-on-one relationship where we had too many people talking to too many Bechtel people, and Bechtel people were between us and the execution contractors. And we came to the conclusion that we should wipe out one of those layers. And, of course, we wouldn't want to wipe ourselves out. So what we did was we took the role of Bechtel and reduced it from a management role to a technical services support type role. And as you know, that's still where we are today. And I guess looking down the road from here, the project management organization, as we see it today, is probably going to remain that way. Now, I might just mention one thing, that project management is an once it's assigned a task, its task is to get that job done and then do itself out of business. Here we are, the project is not even halfway done, and we already have demobilization plans made. We already know how we're going to work ourselves out of business and go do something else, hopefully even more challenging than this. And I guess I ought to mention one other thing, and that is that the need to bring aboard execution contractors, for instance, pipeline contractors. And I guess I ought to explain what was the difference between the Bechtel role and the Fluor role. As I mentioned, we brought Bechtel aboard as a construction management contractor. They were going to be an extension of our project management. And they were going to, then they would manage the execution contractor's activities. Now, the Fluor role is a bit different. Fluor was given the engineering to do. They were given the procurement, they were given the planning, and then they were given the job of being the general contractor for construction. They will construct the stations and the terminal with subcontractors and with direct hire people. Some of the employees working in the field will actually be Fluor employees. They all come from the same pool. Now, as I mentioned earlier, we once decided to have one CMC, and then we broke it to two. And I think that move was a good one because it separated the pipeline-type activities from the stations and terminal-type activities. They're different types, and they use different contractual and union arrangements. The other thing that's different is the fact that pipeline contractors in the lower 48 or in other parts of the world, when they bid a project, they do it on a sort of a unit price basis. I mean, they'll go and bid the job in competition with one another, and the one who bids the lowest dollars per mile gets the job, at least that's normally. Now, there wasn't a contractor in the world that would dare bid this job. As you know, this is not a normal pipeline. It's not normal because of the permafrost and because of the above ground portion of the pipeline, the weather, and the various other problems. And so all of these contractors, they also had to learn something. So the contracts we have with them are really fixed fee and reimbursable labor contracts. And so far, that seems to be working out very well. And in order to give them more incentive, we gave them an incentive approach, where if they underrun the estimate and beat the schedule, they have opportunities for earning additional fee. And after all, everyone's in business to make fee. And of course, if they make all their bonus, we come out looking pretty good too, because they would be finished early and finish ahead of under the budget. Now, the I guess in summary, talking about project management, what is it and how does it work? I think you have to think of it in terms of a task force effort that is put into business to do an assignment, to recognize weaknesses where they exist and to take corrective action very fast. In fact, the best project managers are those who anticipate problems. I mean, people like myself and my key people on my staff, they should not be worrying about day-to-day activities. That should be delegated down to people to worry about those. We should be spending our time thinking about, are we doing today the things that will allow us to do 3 months from today what we really want to do in 6 months, in a year. And so it's a constant looking ahead, analyzing your situation, determining if everything is taking place that should be taking place, not only in the field, but in the vendor shops, in the engineering board, in expediting, wherever. And so I guess one of the things that, at least in my book, that makes project management exciting is that every job is different. Everyone has new challenges. Everyone has new problems. And everyone, it fires up a person's enthusiasm to get on it, to get on with it, and to get it done. And then we are just as enthusiastic to get off and go on and do something else. So I don't know if going through it the way I did, I was able to explain to you how Alyeska Project managed this job and to a degree of how we got to be what we are. And so I guess with that in mind, I'd like to conclude my presentation and open the thing up to questioning, and hopefully I'll be able to answer your many questions. I hope many questions. Okay.
What will happen to the Alyeska company once the pipeline is done?
Well, we have as one of the divisions, as you know, is operations division that reports to Charlie Elder. Alyeska will become an operating company. It will be in Alaska as long as the pipeline is here, and it'll have its headquarters someplace in Alaska. But you'll hear more about that when Mr. Elder comes here and makes a presentation. Yes.
Why was Bellevue chosen as your main site for the corporate headquarters?
Well, Bellevue was chosen at the time because it was certainly in Seattle, which is the gateway to Alaska. And at that time, the president thought that it would be a good idea to be there as long as it's in the lower 48 because of the time difference. It's only 2 hours between Alaska and 2 hours between Texas and 3 hours to New York. At that time, ARCO had its headquarters in New York, and so did BP.
If you're to do another project of somewhere near the scope, have you learned anything on management in the north that would cause you to organize differently than you did for this one?
Oh, yes, I think so. I think, of course, you gain by experience. I think the thing that is hard to get across is that I think the people who started this project would have done it differently, except all of the problems with the environmentalists and the government getting the permits. And it was a sort of stop-and-go operation where things were running hot and then they were running cold. I think once you get into a project and build up momentum and can sustain that momentum, that's what makes it successful. Like, we started construction in a field, and that's going, starting, you know, it really takes off because you can keep it going. We were not allowed to keep it going. But to answer you even more accurately, yes, we would do things a bit differently.
I think the things that probably
be done differently, I would not recommend taking on all of the engineering the way we did. I certainly would recommend making a decision very early in the game as to how the project is going to be managed. Sit down and figure that out first. And get a commitment from the owners, yes, they will give you the people or they will not. Then if they will not, then say, well, okay, we will hire a contractor to do this, we will hire another one to do that. We'll organize our management group, and I'm talking just a management group. We'll organize it this way, and then we will start that way. It'll change as you go through it, but at least you'd have a broader base to start from. Yes, ma'am.
You were an Exxon. You came from Exxon.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. My one question is on R&M and Michael Baker. Would you elaborate on that?
Well, R&M played quite a varied role. They, of course, designed the Live and Good Road. They assisted us in gathering of the geotechnical information in the field. They analyzed the core samples that were taken out of the ground by other drilling firms. They've been our consultant during the design of the pipeline. And they currently still support our engineering and still support our field activity.
When you say Live and Good Road, you're not talking about the slippery part between Fairbanks and Live and Good, are you?
I'm talking about the good road. Not the bad road that was there before we got here.
Well, I don't understand what you mean, Live and Good Road.
Well, it's the road that was built to extend the highway around Fairbanks. It goes, I can't give you the exact description. I know it goes by Live and Good, and that's why we call it the Live and Good Road. I think it was, 29 miles or something like that?
56
miles. There's 56 miles of highway that was built in order to allow us to have move traffic up to the Yukon River. And there's a bit of the road that was not improved, and that's the part that is giving everyone the troubles during the wintertime.
Then Michael Baker.
Now, Michael Baker, as you know, is an engineering firm with headquarters in, I think it's Beaver, Pennsylvania. And they were brought aboard because they are road builders, designers, civil. They're a big civil engineering design firm. Now, they were employed because they had the know-how. They were selected early in the game, and I think the quality of their work is quite evident when you look at that Yukon River Highway. I think they did a good job of designing it.
They designed the road from the Yukon to Prudhoe?
Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Do you feel that the withholding of the permit from 69 to 74 eventually helped Alyeska in taking a look at some of the hard questions that they hadn't looked at before in design and logistics?
Oh, I think so. I think if you look at the original concept, they were thinking of 200 miles above ground and 600 miles in the ground, and now we're half and half, 400 above and 400 below. I think it did bring to focus the problems that should be anticipated when one builds in a permafrost, yes. I think that it forced Alyeska to do a lot more than it may have thought it had to do at that time. Yes, sir.
Have you advanced the scheduled completion dates? We were on the field trip Sunday down to Pump Station 8, and at that time one of the personnel down there told us they have a new completion that they're shooting for November 76.
Who are you talking to? In the pipeline?
One of the pump station people.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, the job of project management, as I said, is to improve schedule, and we obviously will try to do that. We know, for instance, that the target dates for the completion of the pipeline portion of the project are August, September, October, depending on which contractor you're looking at. So the pipeline should be finished before next winter. Now, the reason we want to do that is we want to hydrostatically test the pipeline before the onslaught of winter. And if we don't do it then, we have to wait until spring, and that's too long a period. Now, the critical part of this project has always been the terminal. We do believe that there is a chance of finishing enough pump stations so that oil could be moved through the pipeline in early 77. And it's what's going to determine how soon we were able to move oil through this pipeline is going to be the terminal. And we are currently studying what are the minimum facilities required at the terminal for operation. And once we have a handle on that, then we're going to obviously try to do whatever we can to improve the completion date. Yes, ma'am.
I had two questions, and one is when we were at the pump station the other day, the guy there mentioned that they were starting to lay off a lot of the workers, and I wanted to know, like, which areas were they being laid off in, and like how? I mean, was it the laborers or?
Yeah, okay. I think I can answer your question. First of all, I'd be awful surprised if we're laying off people at the stations that work at the stations, because we intend to work those through the winter. As soon as our objective at the stations this winter is to get as many buildings up as we can get up, including the at the terminal. And that'll allow us to work during the winter inside the buildings. And obviously, if you're working inside a building, productivity should be as good in the wintertime as in the summertime. Now, on the pipeline portion of the project, we do not intend to maintain the workforce that we have. And the way we're going to go about reducing our forces, if there is a crew out in the field putting in VSMs, for instance, and it no longer can function efficiently, we will just eliminate that crew. And so all of the various trades that are involved in that activity would be released from the project.
I had one other thing to ask, and that was on the unions and hiring and Teamsters. I mean, how do you do your hiring?
This is another topic that I don't know how it's going to be covered in the session. I don't think it will be quite adequately. We have what is called a project labor agreement, which is an agreement that was entered into by Alyeska with the international unions. And all of the conditions of employment are agreed to in that agreement. And there's a no-strike provisions, and there are provisions for arbitration when differences of opinion exist. And the whole purpose of that agreement is to allow us to build this pipeline project without having strikes, without having jurisdictional disputes between unions. And, you know, where one union claims that that's the work that this union should do rather than the other union. And so we think that we have a very good agreement. Now, you have heard of some disruptive effects, the Teamsters and the 798 welders, or the UA. Well, those were internal strifes where the Teamsters decided they weren't going to drive the buses, and that stopped us from working. And we told them, you get to work because we have an agreement, and legally you must go to work. And they did not go to work. We went to court and got a temporary injunction. It prohibits them from stopping work. Now, if they stop work, we can then have them arrested. I mean, it's a criminal offense. We have a contract, and both parties have to live up to that contract. And we, in turn, can sue them for damages, and what it cost us as a result of their unauthorized work stoppage. So it gives us the, so to speak, the mutual agreement that they have to do their thing and we have to do ours. And as long as we're prepared to do ours, they have to do theirs.
Well, I can see that, but...
Now, if anyone wants to get hired for the project, we have agreed that they have to come in through one of the unions that are signatories to the agreement. So if anyone wants to work on the project, there are two ways to get on the project. One is to join a union and go to the union hall and apply for a job. The other is to get a job with one of the contractors, even though you are not a union member. And if that contractor offers you a job, then you go become a union member in one of the signatory unions for the particular work that you want to do, and then you can be employed that way as well.
Well, what about, like, native workers?
Well, native workers, they do the same thing. Alyeska also has obligations to hire certain numbers of natives, certain number of other minorities, and we even have to hire minority contractors, native contractors. So we have certain, they may not be totally legal obligations, but at least we've agreed to do these things, and I think Alyeska has maintained a very good record in hiring of locals and natives and minorities, females too. Go ahead.
What impact will the fact that all the barges didn't get through to Prudhoe Bay have on the probable ultimate date of oil delivery?
Well, that's a sort of a two-pronged question for me, because Alyeska, for the pipeline activities, only had two barge loads of equipment, or two barge loads of materials, I should say, rather than equipment, going up the slope, consisting mainly of cement. We were planning to move a lot of cement up there by barge so that we could use it at the pump stations north. And also, we had pipe on there for the fuel gas line. As you know, there's a fuel gas line that will feed the first four pump stations. Well, what we've done is we've diverted those barges back down to southern Alaska, down to Seward, and some, or if not most, of that pipe is already up north. So it's not, it will not have an effect on the pipeline except for the added cost. Now, for the producers, and I can only speak secondhand, I'm not directly involved, I understand that they have got the critical barges in, and the rest of the material that has been diverted, they will move up by truck, and they'll be in the position to achieve the target dates consistent with the pipeline. And again, it only means more money. Okay.
At what time was Bechtel brought online to, or when was a contract issued to them?
The contract to Bechtel was issued late in 73. I can give you the exact date. I don't really have it. But it was in the, I believe it was the third quarter of 73. And then we went into construction in 74, early 74.
Right. So they might have had 6 months
preparation
time before. Okay, were their duties primarily going to parallel your office, or would they have come under pipeline on the management chart?
They would have reported to the Frank Mullen. As you know, Frank wasn't in charge at that time. It was Tom Kafedimas. But if the thing had gone the way we had originally planned, they would have been reporting to Frank Mullen as the...
They would have been between Frank Mullen and...
And the execution contractors.
I understand. Mm-hmm.
They would be an extension of project management. Would have been. And now they provide merely a functional responsibility in certain disciplines, not in all disciplines.
How much direct day-to-day contact do you have with people like Frank Mullen?
Me?
Yes.
Oh, I talk to him, I'd say, 5 to 10 times a day, sometimes all day. I mean, he's away, as you know, I don't know if you know, he's away for about 3 days, and I talked to him yesterday from San Francisco, so... We keep in close touch. I keep in close touch with all my key people. I try not to overburden them with my presence. I'm a great believer. Excuse me one second. I'm a great believer in giving a man an assignment and a responsibility, and then giving him enough freedom to do it. And if he does it well, then all I have to know is that it's going well. And you can't just... another lesson you learn as a manager is you never just take it for granted, even though it seems to be going well.
This rather practical question, would it be possible to get access to your notes or some condensation of those?
Of these things I have here?
Yeah. You went through such very interesting history on the project, and it was pretty hard to get it.
I see no objection to it. Larry has a copy of these things. I did not follow all the things I wrote in here. Otherwise, I'd be still talking, and you'd probably get stopped listening. That gentleman back there, can you pass the mic back? Oh, yes,
I have one here. You mentioned in your talk earlier that the Bechtel layer of management was removed. We heard here in Fairbanks, I think this spring, some questions about gold plating on Bechtel's part, the idea that there was perhaps waste and mismanagement. Can you elaborate on that particular allegation?
Sure, I think so. On any big project like this one, there's going to be some waste and some, misappropriation of materials and what have you. Now, I don't think that we can attribute that to Bechtel. Now, we needed better warehouse facilities. Take, for example, I'm sure you're more familiar with Fairbanks than I am. You're familiar with the North Star Terminal now as a facility. You take a look at where we stored all of our materials before, at the airport and open warehouses, at the pipe storage yard. It was very hard to control materials, and we needed them desperately, but we had no security. I mean, things were sort of spread around. Now, you've heard of people say we got ripped off. Well, I'm sure we did to a degree. But whether I can attribute that to Bechtel or to not being ready on our part, that's a hard question to really respond to. I think I would like to just put it another way. I would give Bechtel all their due. They did help us do many things. Now, just because we reduced their role doesn't mean that they did it badly. I mean, everything badly. There are some things they did we didn't like, but that's true at every contractor. There are things Fluor is doing we don't like, and we try to improve on. And another thing, of course, is that the contractor you dislike the most is the one you're working with. I mean, that just goes without saying. Because, you know, our job is always being critical of people. We're always trying to improve performance. You could be doing the best job in the world, and we still want it done better. And so we're always very critical. It's a critical business. It's the nature of it. So, no, I'd say this, that I would, I think I would, on the official record, give Bechtel their due for the things they did do well, detract from them somewhat for the things they didn't do so well. And of course, we were responsible for a lot of that, too. I mean, we could have stopped it earlier if we were smart enough or knew enough.
You covered project management up through the construction phase fairly well, but what do you see in the operations and maintenance phase as far as project management goes?
Project management will be in existence until all the facilities are complete and the pipeline is operational, at which point in time it'll go the way of all project management, disappear.
What do you see in the way of management for that phase then, the operations and maintenance phase?
Well, the operations and maintenance phase, you mean in terms of who's going to do it? It'll be a corporate structure, and that'll be described by Mr. Elder. I think he'll be here in a few weeks to talk to you about that. He'll tell you about the number of people and how he plans to organize for it. I would not like to preempt him, and I'd probably be wrong anyway. Yes, sir.
Don't you agree that if you didn't have to hire so many minorities and so many Alaskans, you could get the job done faster?
Oh, I don't know. It's a hard question to answer. Hiring minorities who are not as experienced, perhaps, as some of the other craftsmen certainly does carry some debits with it. Now, whether I can tell you quantify those, I don't think I know how to do that. But let's face it, we're in a world that we live in, and the world that we live in requires us to do that. So every project has to pick up its share of bringing forward the minorities that were not brought forward in the past. I guess this generation is going to pay the penalty for the things that were done in the past. Yes, sir.
Since 1973, rents in Fairbanks really have increased quite a lot. I was wondering whether Alyesk has any social viewpoints about what they should do to lower rents and lower the cost of living in Fairbanks and other areas. Are there any?
Well, I don't think that Alyeska can do anything. Alyeska, I guess we have done something, but whether it directly contributes to lower rents, I can't say. For instance, we did build a lot of our own housing. We did provide additional apartments. We did do many things to take care of, obviously, our own needs and our own people. When the project is completed and we start reducing our forces in Fairbanks, all of these should become available to the people. So I think they'll reap the benefits of it later, but not right now. Mm-hmm. You're in a boom situation here in Fairbanks. In fact, all of Alaska is in a boom situation. And it's, you know, axiomatic. Its costs are going to go up. Yes, sir.
Has turnover been higher than anticipated?
I think turnover has been... Yes, I'd say in a sense, yes. I just don't remember all the numbers to respond to you. But again, if you, I guess Larry will make a note to ask Mr. Patton to bring that turnover data with him when he comes. He knows more about it than I do. The people who keep those records and maintain them report to him. And I just don't remember them. Yes, ma'am.
You're already contemplating the reduction in force and the completion of the job. I mean, and that is in your planning now. Are you looking toward the construction, or are any of your people looking toward the construction of gas pipelines in Alaska or into Canada or from the Canadian Arctic Islands? Or
well, of course, we in Alyeska are, you know, we're only concerned with one pipeline. That's the one we're working on. If you know, the gas line is built, I personally can only speak as an individual, not a representative of Alyeska. I certainly hope it's decided soon, because I think that much of the construction equipment and camps that we have can certainly be utilized to good advantage.
Your camps, according to your contract, the camps that you have now have to be removed. But
our contract calls for us to remove all temporary facilities
and return the site to original state.
Return it as near as possible to its original condition.
Mm-hmm. We've rolled off the tape, so thank you very much for your time tonight.
Good.
Well. As for the plan, the only thing that I can think of that technically we could do better the next time is hold the microphone closer to your mouth and talk a little bit louder.